Hi everyone, my name is Agon Homza. As always, I am here with my friend and colleague Frank Ruda. We are very happy to welcome back old listeners and welcome our first time listeners to Christ and Critique podcast, Philosophy and its other scene. Frank and I are thrilled to announce our guest today, a guest who is very important to both of us, both theoretically and politically. But before the introduction, let me mention just a few things. Our next episode, scheduled to be recorded in a few weeks, will be with Mladen Dolar. If you like the work that we are doing both with the journal as well as with the podcast, we would highly appreciate if you could support us at Patreon. We would also be very grateful if you could subscribe to our YouTube, Spotify, and other channels. You find all the information in the bio. At the same time, Frank and I are working in completing the new forthcoming issue of the journal of new issue of the forthcoming of a journal. It will be devoted to the new right, which, given the current political and ideological conjuncture, we believe to be a very pertinent topic. But I am very thrilled to welcome our today's guest, Silvia Federici. Federici is a scholar, activist, political theorist, and one of the leading contemporary feminists. In 1972, together with Maria Rosa de la Costa and Selma James, she co-founded the International Feminist Collective, which launched the campaign Wages for Housework internationally. She is professor emerita and teaching fellow at Hofstra University in New York State. Previously, in the mid-80s, if I am not mistaken, she taught at the University of Port Harcourt in Nigeria. Federici is known for her focus on the struggle against capitalist globalization and more recently on developing a feminist theory of the commons. Her most famous work, The Caliban and the Witch, which incidentally this year marks its 20th anniversary, of the publication, undertakes a critique of Marxist concept of primitive accumulation. In fact, it was often described as a counterpoint of it, in which Federici reconstructs the history of capitalism, highlighting and emphasizing the continuity between capitalist subjugation of women, decolonization of Americas, and slave trade. Federici has published many books, and I will enumerate just a few of them. Wages Against Housework in 1975, Caliban and the Witch, Women, the Body and the Primitive Accumulation in 2004, Revolution at the Point Zero, Housework, Reproduction and Feminist Struggle in 2012, Reenchanting the World, Feminism and the Politics of Commons in 2018, Witches, Witch Hunting and Women in 2018 as well, Beyond the Periphery of the Skin, Rethinking, Remarkingly Reclaiming the Body in Contemporary Capitalism in 2020, Patriarchy of the Wage, Notes on Marx, Gender and Feminism in 2021. She has also co-edited many books, as well as she has published many essays and articles. It is my honor and pleasure to welcome Silvia Federici to our podcast. Thank you so much for joining us today. Now I hand things over to my friend to start off the conversation.
Thank you to you for inviting me.
And also, I'm very grateful and want to express my gratitude to you for joining us. We want to start with a rather general question. As Agon just remarked, 20 years ago, Caliban and the Witch was published. And the origin of the books is linked to your collaboration, if we are not mistaken, with Leopoldina Fortunati and the book that you co-authored. It is certainly and without any doubt a book that had a huge impact, not only on contemporary feminism, but also on emancipatory theory, that's a theory in the left field in general. How do you, would you evaluate our contemporary situation from the standpoint of the Caliban and the Witch? Do you think you would add something looking back from the standpoint of today?
Mm. Yeah, I think mostly two things. One thing is the fact that when I wrote the book, if you notice, only at the very, very end, I mentioned that there was an appearance of a new witch hunts that were taking place in some parts of the world. But I was still not very sure about the extent of those persecution, of this new persecution. Now, you know, after so many years, after I actually can say that one of the things, and this is why I wrote another booklet, you know, Women, Witch Hunting and Witches, because I wanted to bring attention to the fact that since at least the mid-90s, and certainly as a consequence of the broad worldwide process of expansion of capitalist relation, what we call globalization, you know, in many, many parts of the world, witch hunting has returned, and hundreds, if not thousands, of women have been executed, you know, pushed out of their villages, forced to abandon their villages, burnt alive in many cases. In Ghana, until recently, I understand that recently the government of Ghana is trying to shut down this concentration camp, but there are concentration camps for women accused of witchcraft, and this is in the north of Ghana. So the situation is extremely, extremely serious, although I must say it has pained me that feminist movement across the world, except those in the very areas where these witch hunts have taken place, they have not taken up the struggle against this horrendous, you know, problem that has extended recently also to children. You know, so in Nigeria, for instance, Angola, the Congo, now witch hunting has also extended to children. So much so that in 2023, in parts of southeastern Nigeria, there were marches of children, you know, with basically banners saying, we are not witches. So this to me is one of the most important part, you know, the looking back to the time the book was published, one important difference is I didn't think as I was working on the book that I was writing about the future as well. And the other element that you know, is a continuity with the book, which in fact has unfolded, I think, are the motivation. You know, in, as you know, in Caliban and the Witch is a constant theme, is the fact that these witch hunts are rooted, you know, has their fundamental causes in the process of primitive accumulation, the dispossession of the peasantry from the land, the commercialization of agriculture, in many cases, in the replacement, you know, of the peasantry with, for example, the case of England, you know, with sheep. Thomas More, right? Sheep are eating human beings, you know, for the wool. In other words, the decommercialization, privatization of agriculture was directly connected. And I think that this is true today more than ever. I think that today, in fact, you know, in some parts in India, you know, I understand that for many, in Africa also, for many women to have access to some land, to inherit a piece of land, is almost a condemnation to being accused to be a witch, particularly older women. All women who are isolated, live alone, they don't have people who are ready to fight for them, to protect them. So this massive assault on the land, this massive expansion that is privatizing it, it's you know, destined to monoculture by big corporation, and in particular, you know, in the wake of the International Monetary Fund Structural Adjustment Program, which has forced country upon country in Africa, in Latin America, to open their door, you know, to all kinds of extractivist companies, mining, petroleum, and agribusiness, not to mention women's bodies, that these witch hunts, there is a connection. There is a fundamental connection that is still valid more than ever. Yeah. And I would say that many of the wars that are now taking place across the world have their roots precisely in those processes of dispossession.
If we can remain in the topic of contemporary witch hunting. In Witches, Witch Hunting and Women, you argue that, as you said just now, that witch hunting is returning. And the lesson we need to draw from that is that this form of persecution is not bound to a specific historic time. Its mechanisms can be applied to different societies, wherever and whenever there are people that are to be ostracized or dehumanized. Witch hunting accusations are the ultimate mechanisms of alienation and estrangement, because they turn the accused, which are predominantly women, into monstrous being. Another aspect of this is that it is meant to destroy the communal relations by the way of injecting suspicion, etc. Could we say that this is happening today, let's say in the university campuses, or professors being canceled and so on? But on the other hand, we have somebody like Donald Trump, who has claimed to be a victim of witch hunting. Is there a right-wing appropriation of this trope for different means?
Witch hunting in a way has become a kind of the iconic representation, iconic image, right, of a persecution who is totally legitimate, you know, fabricated, untenable, absolutely ridiculous, untenable, right? And in that way, it's an open reality. Everybody can also use it, right? But, you know, and I'd like to make a parallel here now with the charge of anti-Semitism. Now everybody's an anti-Semite. You know, students who are protesting, you know, the genocide in Palestine are accused of being anti-Semitic, even though many of them had their parents, you know, killed in Hitler's concentration camps. So the effect is, of course, is diluting, if not hiding, the horror of their reality, you know. And I would say that today, you know, women are still persecuted, executed on the charge of being witches. And now we have instead this appropriation by people like Trump and others, speaking of witch hunting in situations which are completely, completely different. And so we have to be, of course, very, very careful with the way in which ideology, right, become in fact domesticated, you know, by usages that in fact not only are illegitimate to represent the reality, but they also have the effect of hiding what is actually taking place. And this is the case with the witch hunting. So we don't hear of the women being burned, you know, for instance, in Africa, in Tanzania, in Angola, in the Congo. But we hear instead of, these right wingers, you know, speaking of witch hunting, because they are finally, you know, made to pay something for their crimes.
Maybe to move on a little, you indicated, I think, repeatedly that Marx invents and offers a language and the necessary categories to conceive of capitalism in its totality and to understand, broadly speaking, the logic that drives its reproduction. But you added to this, I think, and that is crucial, that this analysis of reproduction of labor force has to be supplemented by a feminist perspective, that is, with an analysis of reproductive activities, reproductive practices that do not play a systematic role in Marxism, more broadly speaking, in Marxist accounts at all. This is to say that any analysis of what is determining for labor under capitalism cannot be properly articulated without a feminist perspective, since only the latter brings to the fore how capitalism conceptually and systematically cannot do without unpaid labor, without this dispossessions, and so forth. The question then is how this reliance of capitalism on unpaid labor necessitated a transformation of the particularly female body into a productive force. Could you tell us how this transformation, in broad strokes maybe, operated and how it was, if we may say so, naturalized?
Yeah, I think actually two things. Not only capitalism requires unpaid labor of different types. In fact, you know, more and more, I mean, the analogy I make is that capitalism, you know, builds, you know, islands of prosperity if we look across the world. And those islands are predicated on the massive existence of what now we call sacrifice zones. You know, they actually call them sacrifice zones. You know, so the necessity, you know, of establishing very different, you know, form regime of exploitation and introducing hierarchies, both to divide people, both to divide the oppressed, but also to be able, you know, to extract, you know, far more intense, you know, to impose far more intense forms of exploitation by naturalizing them, you know, in creating these, you know, distorted images of the people, the slave, you know, the proletarian, the colonial people, the women. So this is where the question of capitalist patriarchal relation comes into place. No, why they need these, obviously, these differences. They need unpaid labor and naturalize it, but at the same time they also need, equally important in the case of women, reproductive work. So capitalism needs women to reproduce the workforce. It needs to basically do most of the work that is necessary for labor to be able to be exploited. So the work of women in the history of capitalism has been to create the condition of existence of every labor activity. And this is the most fundamental. Clearly, naturalizing this work, making it appear there is animal-like, there is something that has to do with nature, nothing to do with social relation, nothing to do with economy, nothing to do with the, you know, capitalist organization of work, right? It has allowed for this immense flow of free labor, unpaid labor, right? And it has allowed also for a disciplining, because the moment it is naturalized, then it's very difficult to fight against it. First of all, the lack of a compensation has placed women in a condition of dependence, which is already a condition of disciplining. Women have had to deal not only with capital in the last analysis, but also with, you know, men have become the supervisor of their work, have become those who have basically controlled that they actually perform. You know, we used to say that we have the state, you know, in the kitchen and in the bedroom, you know, because men, in many ways, the wage worker has been the representative of the state, the one who makes sure that the woman is really performing the work, and often resorting to violence, to physical or emotional violence, if she does not, you know. And naturalizing it has meant that it's been difficult for her. I wrote in one of my articles that if a worker refuses to work, he's an heroic striker. But if a woman refuses to work, she's a bad woman. She's unnatural. She's a bad mother. So this naturalization has been such a powerful element of discipline for women. And of course, has meant being able to amass a fortune. A capitalism that would have to compensate women's work of reproduction is a capitalism that would never have been able to accumulate the immense amount of wealth that they have accumulated on women's backs.
You have frequently criticized Marxist theory for one could potentially call its internal assumption of the progressive nature of capitalism. One version of this critique can be resumed in the assumption that we first have to be organized by capital before we can organize ourselves. As a result of this, you insist on a novel evaluation of a class of class struggles, an evaluation that can make visible what otherwise is structurally indivisibilized. Notably, that the most valuable product that is offered on a capitalist market is produced and more essentially reproduced by invisible female labor.
Mm-hmm.
But if this is the case, then the Marxist assumption that the revolutionary force has to have or assume a certain assumption in the production process also becomes problematic. The problematicity of this problem is connected to the idea that certain objective conditions first need to be fulfilled before they can be an emancipation or a revolution. Can you say a few words about what this change of perspective you have been advocating?
Yes.
Just like you've been advocating this for a very long time. So
it's a big difference. You know, I learned a lot from Marx and I use a lot Marx, and I still you know, go accept deeply. I mean, the Marx critique of capitalism as a system based on the exploitation of labor. What I don't agree, and that's where I part ways with Marx, is the, you know, view of how we fight capitalism, the view of what is the anti-capitalist struggle, and the idea, you know, that capitalism lays the material condition because of industry, because of large-scale industry and so forth. So this idea that of a world in which when the objective condition will be mature means that industrialization will have reached certain levels. That, I think, is out. And I think more and more people are actually beginning to see that. You know, we see that the kind of industrialization that, you know, obviously Marx was looking at is now destroying the world. But more specifically, what you're pointing out, this idea that in a way the revolutionary worker for Marx, right? And this is why he's insistent the revolutionary worker is the wage worker, and particularly the industrial worker, because the idea that it has to be a worker that has absorbed, has learned from capitalism, in a way has incorporated, right, the progressive part of capitalism. Right, worked in industry, and therefore is revolutionary because not just because of its opposition to capitalism, but because it has learned from capital, and therefore can build a society that will not have all those elements that Marx thought, scarcity, toil, etc., etc. And this, I think, is a big problem. In Marx. Actually, you know, our view, and I say mine, but I think a lot of women's view, of the role that the work that you oppressed, the work that you exploited are doing in a capitalist society, the role that this work has in the struggle and in the post-capitalist society is exactly the opposite. No, for us, it is very important that women being confined to reproductive work, you know, and recognizing that this work has been very oppressive in the way it has been organized. But nevertheless, you know, because of that experience of reproduction, because of that, you know, generational experience of dealing with the need to ensure day upon day, generation upon generation, right? The people live, the people are healthy, the people are emotionally reproduced, not only physically, not only, but that this kind of experience that women have, you know, carried out, you know, every day for generation is for us the most important experience in the construction, in the struggle against capitalism, and in the construction of a new society. And, you know, I often say that the feminist movement, you know, is the movement that is most, in a way, important in the anti-capitalist struggle. you know, precisely because of this long experience with the reproduction of life and long experience with a perspective that gives value to life, with a perspective which in fact is utterly antithetical, you know, to the capitalist view that fundamentally, essentially devalues life, subordinates life to the accumulation of wealth. And I'm saying that the work that women have done, that all immense history of reproducing people, reproducing workers, child raising, and so on, has also created a particular type of subjectivity. It's not an accident. The men have been the one until so far, you know, that have filled the armies. They have the one who have done the work of the hangman. They've been the executioners. No, it's not an accident that somehow this division of labor means something. And to us, it means that, in fact, the values that women have developed and learned, you know, through the process of reproduction are the ones that we need to carry with us as we create, as we fight, and as we create a new society. So it's not the industrial workers' knowledge who knows how to, you know, maneuver the machine. It's like the woman who is actually knows what he's dealing with, the children, with the elderly, with the food, with the ecology, because food, you know, feeding and cooking is connected with the environment, with healthcare, is connected with education, is connected with spirituality, is connected with all the things that make our life worth living.
Does all this mean for the Holy Family, to quote Marx and Engels out of context? We mean, what does it mean for the very concept of the family, right? What precise role does it play in your analysis? Well, on the one hand side, as something like an institutionalized instrument of suppression or disciplining that implies a splitting of the working class between men and women, as well as an instrument that creates something like a belief that there is a detached private sphere that would be somewhat independent from capitalist society, where especially women were supposed to be okay with not receiving a wage because they received the gift of love.
Right, absolutely. You know, somebody has said that, you know, the family is like the union in capitalism, right? It protects you, and at the same time, it enslaves you, because it protects you to the extent that you actually work for capital, that you actually perform in a way that it's instrumental to the capitalist discipline of work. And I think that we have to think of the family historically and very, very different. Already, I think the family is changing, right? We have families that are extended, that are not based on blood ties, that are not based on the dependency, dependent relation, you know, but they are much more horizontal in the relation that people have. So I think that the family might sail into the new world, but in a very different format, and in a format that is already, you know, I think that at least since the 70s and even earlier, there's been every revolutionary movement has experimented with changing the family, even within capitalism, you know, and now the traditional family is breaking down, you know, even because of the forces, you know, with the crisis of the male wage, already the family has entered, as we know it, at least, you know, in the North, in the so-called global North, it's already. So, you know, clearly a relation of great intensity will continue, but in a very, very, very different world.
So thus far, we have already seen that you also complicate the concept of class struggle. You have also been explicit about the fact that if needed, capitalism retorts to any dividing form of discourse and ideology that could work, from sexism to racism to classism, as it is a system that uses whatever it can to instigate another level of primitive accumulation, of what David Harvey would call accumulation by dispossession. Your position here seems to differ, at least in nuances, if not more, not only from Marx, who, for some of his readers, thought that primitive accumulation is usually understood as an act occurring once in history and so on, but also from someone like Rosa Luxemburg, who claimed that it is a repeated act that is implemented each and every time there is a realization problem and capitalism is in crisis. Are we correct in reading reading your position such that you claim that there is no capitalism, capitalist reproduction without primitive accumulation?
Well, this actually is a complicated question, because I think there are particular moments in which the process of dispossession is actually happening on a broad scale and in particular intense forms. And for example, I would say that the IMF, they launched in 1975, through a very artificially organized debt crisis and the launching of a program of structural adjustment, that have really swept the world, from in almost every country. And they have literally in every country, produced mass devaluation of currency, forced government to reorient their economy in a way that have taken them back to their colonial status, so that everything has to be diverted to export, so that the investment of this government that were coming out of colonialism, investment in the reproduction, of their communities had to be cut. School, education. When I was in Nigeria, I saw this, and with my eyes, the cutting of investment in education, in healthcare, etc. So these moments are very important. But there is another primitive accumulation that continues. You can say that colonization has been an ongoing process of primitive accumulation. And today also, mechanisms have been put into place. I like to say, and I don't know how elegantly and accurately I can do this, but I think the division of labor that capitalism has instituted through the history of colonization and the new form of colonialism, right, which are both financial and military at the same time, right? So the fact, for example, that so much of the production of what is consumed in Europe, in the United States, is the product of a dispossession of people across the world. That ongoing daily, primitive accumulation built into the division of labor. There is a division of labor that is built on dispossession and war. Dispossession and war are not any longer, exception. They're not any longer responses to moments of great crisis. They are built into the organization of work, the organization of consumption. So that, for example, the food that people should consume in Mexico, right, is now being sold, or the land that people would use in Mexico, or in any part of Latin America, for crops that would nourish them. That land is now, when it's not devoted, to mineral extraction, is devoted to produce food stuff that goes to New York, that goes to Chicago, et cetera, et cetera. So that is an built-in primitive accumulation that I think is part, of this process of mass impoverishment, mass migration. People are leaving their countries because they have nothing on which to build the future. They have nothing on which to support themselves. And then, of course, they are punished by the very same government who are, you know, forcing them, who are dispossessing them, who are in a sense, yeah. So this is what it seems to me important to see. This is the ongoing primitive accumulation that is taking place. And this is why we now have not only the occasional wars, but we have an ongoing warfare. When you look at the state of the world, the United States has 800 bases across the world, 800 bases. Just in the Middle East over the last 15, 20 years, the United States has spent the $4 trillion in Afghanistan, in Iraq, you know, with the repeated wars that have been very, very, very devastating. And wars that, unlike the war of the past, well, of course, here we have to see which past, but more and more are wars that are directly targeting the reproduction of people's life. They are wars that are not between two armies, but they are destroying, you know, water system, you know, roads, schools, libraries, hospitals, like we see in Palestine. I say Palestine is the world in a way, because what the US did in Iraq, you know, was very, very similar to what is happening in Palestine, you know. So I think that undoing of the reproductive system, you know, this global enclosure, there is a sweeping daily global process of enclosure, you know, that is diverting the resources of millions of people, an entire region, diverting them to the happy few. You know, in Europe, some European community, American, Israel, et cetera, et cetera. You know, is the, yeah.
Bring out maybe another aspect of primitive accumulation. Already in Kalaman and the Witch, you argued that one of the main operative aims of capitalism was to, if we may say so, change the ontology of the body and transform it into what you called work machines. But yeah. This transformation is inherently diverse and multiple, so that the stories that have to be taken into account, that have to be told, must also be multiple. I think you once claimed that this rules out the possibility of a universal or maybe also of a neutral standpoint, and therefore must not only include the transformative affects in the history, the history of capitalism has on human agents, but also on animals. This condition of having been dispossessed, and maybe one could say, and also of having put limits to what a body can do, to recall here Spinoza's famous point that no one has yet determined what a body can do. This condition is under capitalism then not the questionable privilege, not of one race, not even of one species, but seems to be the condition of all species under capitalism. So maybe one could here speak of something like a negative universal condition or a negative universalism that is brought to the fore. But under such a condition, each is affected by the dispossession, but each group, so to speak, in its singular way, how can we even start to rethink, remake, and reclaim the body in contemporary capitalism, to cite a subtitle of one of your more recent books?
Well, you know, I'm brought back to the discussion, you know, when the Zapatistas said, one no, many yeses. One no, many yeses. And the one no is the universal. No, universal no to exploitation. Universal no to hierarchy. Universal no, but many, many yeses, because people are in very diverse, different history, languages, climatic region, et cetera, et cetera, and historical trajectories. So there cannot be one way to the good life. There's not one way to the good life. It's very important to, in fact, recognize and thrive, you know, with that richness of different possibilities. And this applies to the body, applies to climatic region, it applies to people, cultures. And I think it's very, the idea, and this is another possible criticism of the Marxian model, right? This idea of industrialization sweeping the world and bringing uniformity. Marx's idea is bringing, and possibly with very good intention, so that we can all exchange, learn from each other, understand, but actually, ignoring the differences, that those diversities are a richness, and flattening them, it would be bring back the whole misery. See.
Reclaiming the body from a feminist perspective cannot but address the question not only of procreation and thus reproduction, but also of sex and sexual service. You have argued that looking at things from this perspective does, similar to making invisible labor visible, demand that one makes struggles visible that otherwise are not even perceived as struggles. For example, the woman's struggle to avoid pregnancy or sex inside or outside marriage. This implies not only the struggle for abortion right, a topic which is of quite a depressing contemporary significance in the US and even in a Western country like Germany, where abortion is still illegal, but doctors who perform it within the first 12 weeks are not persecuted if the woman went to a mandatory consultation session before the abortion. But the women's struggle also implied the struggle to change the very meaning of the signifier femininity, with a struggle to denaturalize it. On the other hand, capitalism as well as these struggles seem to imply a peculiar form of oblivion or forgetting in your analysis, as you stated, that, I'm quoting you, capitalism has made us lose sight of the magic of life. This is from the beyond the periphery of the scale. Can you tell us more about where precisely you situate this magic and what political resources and powers it allows for?
Yeah, I'm going to say quickly a few things about something about the body for instance, the invisible struggle the total concentration in so many feminist initiatives on the question of abortion has also made invisible the other great problem, which is the denial of maternity. For example, the fact that so many women, and in fact, even in recent time, if not more, have been denied the possibility, particularly Black women under slavery, children taken away, forced to procreate, etc., and denied maternity because the economic condition, the cost of it, has been made so high. And there's a lot more to say, but so that's very, very important, because this has created also a rift between, white feminists, Black feminists, many white feminists equating abortion with choice. And we have been reminded over and over and over by Black feminists that reproductive, rights is not just abortion, is one side of it. Particularly, women have been sterilized, even in recent time, have been sterilized when they have forced the state to put some money to the reproduction of their children, or they've been too combative. And denaturalizing femininity, very important, which has to do with the models of femininity that capitalism through history has imposed, right? Which is not to say that now we have to say that there's no such a thing as women and men. I think recently I was in a discussion, and there were some youth was asking me, when women and men were invented in Africa. And I said, actually, there were women's crop and men's crop long before the colonial people arrived. And there were actually, in some cases, there were even women's languages and men's languages. So let's be careful. Maybe we're talking about model, but let's not throw away everything. Yeah. So that I think is very important. And here, I want to mention Maria Mies, the work of Maria Mies, you know, who died, this big loss, because she was very powerfully insisting. And she was very critical, you know, of the separation between sex and gender, very powerfully insisting that, you know, human beings do not have, are not, you know, for example, the separation of sex and gender presumes that there is a biology reality in a, but she's saying we always experience every aspect of our body through a filter of cultural signification. So we never experience biology, you know, which is this kind of mechanical, this machine that presumably determines us, you know, in the Freudian conception. She's saying, no, there's no such a thing like that, because at all time, the encounter with our bodies has always been an encounter that is cultural, that is mediated through meaning, is mediated through practices. And so in that sense, the naturalization does not mean like throwing away the idea that they are women, throwing away the idea that there are differences. Magic to me, right? Magia means a particular kind of knowledge. Right, Magia is a particular kind of knowledge, and Weber says the capitalism disenchants the world. You know, he was thinking about the bureaucratization of life, but capitalism disenchants the world first of all because it destroys people's relation to nature. It destroyed people's relation to the natural world. You know, and now we are seeing what kind of damage it is done to us, to our soul. So now we look, for instance, at those population in the Amazon, you still have no contact population, or the indigenous that have fought to remain closer to the land, have fought to maintain certain ritual, certain forms of life, that enhance their spirituality. That's the magic. Spirituality is a knowledge, it's a feeling, it's a set of practices that originates by the sense of continuity of our life, of our bodies, with the earth, you know, with the cosmos, with forces that are beyond us. And I think that's been a great power. The cosmovision, people speak of a cosmovision, right, of indigenous people of the Americas. And now we have a feminism, communitarian feminism, that speaks of the body territory, that you cannot defend the territory unless you defend the body, and you cannot separate the body from the land. The body needs the land. So magic is the women in the Sierras of Oaxaca bearing the placenta of their children when they give birth into the ground to signify this really powerful connection, you know, that we exist, that the separation from the land, you know, is an impoverishment. And in knowledge, in feeling, in understanding of the world, in understanding with the forces that are broader than us, right? And in a sense, put into a context this life of us into this earth. That's the magic. The magic is when all the connective tissues that connect us to the world around us, to other people. Love is magic. Love is magic. Imagine. How do you fall in love? What are the mechanisms? How can you explain with poor material the mechanism by which we fall in love? Right? There's something very magical. So there are forces that are interacting that we don't completely understand. Right? So, but we have a capitalism that to discipline us as much as possible has to channel all these powers into ways that are that can be exploited. And in doing that, destroys them. In doing them, domesticates them. And this is why reclaiming the body is reclaiming a world of powers, a world of connection with other people, a world of connection with nature, with animals. That's the magic. So much unhappiness. Most human beings are unhappy today. And not only because of lack of food and displacement and insecurity, you know, which is, of course, fundamental, and war and desperation. But there is, in the United States, two children are committing suicide. There is a broad unhappiness because life has become a set of tasks. It has become a set of mechanical tasks. And the capacity itself for joy, the capacity itself for excitement, for fascination, for connection with other people is lost.
To directly connect to the channeling and destructive capacities of the form in which capitalism cuts the tissue and cuts our ties.
Yes.
I mean, this year marks the 110th anniversary of the First World War. And our situation, as you remarked earlier, seems to be also wars are, maybe one could say, they resurge or they become more visible. I mean, you have yourself written about wars in 2021. You have signed the Feminist Resistance Against War, a manifesto in solidarity with the anti-war resistance initiated by Russian feminists. Wars are all over, Middle East, Africa, Europe. If we include civil wars, the list is much longer. What is your assessment of that situation? You pointed to some aspects already. I mean, have we moved from a situation in which war was once perceived to be an exception to one where it becomes structural? Or would you say that the previous perception was already problematic because there were invisible wars going on and invisibilized wars? I mean, right, one rarely speaks about situations in African countries, right? In the West, one could say right now something changed, but I mean, there was the war in Yugoslavia that people very frequently forget and so forth, right? I mean, so what is your assessment of that?
No, I see that actually, there's a continuity, right? World War One, World War Two, there's a continuity. Capitalism, you know, brings in war on an almost permanent basis. And you're right. Colonialism was a war-like, you know, politics. It was based on total repression. It was based on hanging, execution, dispossession, and the military was always there. So I think that what we are seeing today is more visible, more open, more systematic. And now we see, because so many of the programs that require war are now globalized, internationalized, right? There's a continuity now between Argentina, what is happening in Argentina now, that they have been put, you know, through hell already. Massive people and don't have enough food, don't have enough money to buy what they need. And what is happening in African countries were also, you know, burdened with unpayable debt. Right. So now it's so open, and the militarization also is so very clear. So that we see now that what may have appeared belonging to a face or being typical of a particular situation is in fact structural. I think that today, unless you are a supporter of capitalism, you are a supporter of dispossession, it's really impossible to blind ourselves to this reality. It's very open. Now capitalism requires dispossession, requires impoverishment, systematic, requires refugees, because those lands have to be devoted to oil extraction, agribusiness, green gasoline, or elephant grass, for et cetera. The commercialization of life is so pervasive. And this is the struggle. I think the struggle is exactly that, the reclamation of the body is reclamation of the land. There's no reclamation of the body without reclamation of the territory and the land.
Let us move to another. Oh,
no,
sorry.
A big note. We were, we had, we here in New York had a visit by Raoul Zibeke. I don't know if you know Raoul Zibeke, he's there. And he spoke, you know, of, he spoke at different places and he had all these maps. And in all these maps, it was the most positive talk that I've heard in a long time, because his task was to show us through all these maps and his description that in a lot of places in Latin America, people are creating autonomous communities. People are reclaiming land, they are reclaiming waters, they are reclaiming, and obviously not on a large scale, but there are communities. There is a whole web of struggles. There is a web of struggle of people reclaiming and building autonomous community with practices of self-defense, with practices of communitarian agriculture and so forth. So that was very good. We needed it.
Yeah. Can we move to another aspect of the discussion, in part also because this podcast is called Philosophy and its other other scene. We would like to move to a somewhat lighter topic, so to speak. We would like to ask you, what do you think about the Taylor Swift phenomenon? And not necessarily about her music, but if you have an opinion about that, please do not feel restricted. Is there anything interesting in her, or where you could identify a political potential, or the opposite, or is it completely irrelevant, an irrelevant example of industrialized, globalized culture?
I have to admit that this is one of the questions I'd like to skip, because I really don't know much. You know, it's one of the things that I saw on the horizon that is there, but I never really, probably to my fault, but I never paid. Yes, I should have paid more attention, but there are too many other things to look at. And yeah, I know that she's a big star and she's also presenting herself as a feminist. I heard that she's telling people to vote Biden, and I don't like that.
That was a good enough, a more than good enough answer. But maybe we can speak of this, and we're almost ending our conversation with this. Namely, we were wondering if you could say something about how your work relates to artistic practices in general, to art in general.
Yeah.
Does it play a role for actually the conceptual and systematic aspects of your thought? I mean, it can be literature, painting, film, as other voices come in somehow, right? Through this, would you think it has an impact on how you approach your work,
Well, I mean, many things. There are many things about, you know. Actually, I think if I hadn't thought of me, I think that my first passion in life was art. You know, visual arts as well, of course, literature, but dance, and it continues. I wish also I had more time for it to do. You know, I wrote in praise of the dancing body, you know, that this is there because I've been so impressed by some of the modern dances, people like companies like Alvin Ailey, for instance. You know, these were like revelations about what the body can express, you know, and the relation between body and space. So art is extremely important. And I've actually been very interested about in art in recent time for various reasons. One is because several artists or art theorists have seen a connection and made a connection, particularly feminist art theorists like Katia Prajnik. I don't know if she has written this book called Artwork, you know, from Yugoslavia, where the former Yugoslavia, from Slovenia, where she speaks, she makes a parallel between housework and artwork. She's using the theory that we used, you know, to analyze domestic work. And the connecting is celebrate to devaluate. Celebrate to devaluate. So now the artist, you know, is celebrated, you know, they are art is special. And because of that, artwork should not be compensated. So the how the artwork, and here of course she also uses examples from post-socialist Yugoslavia to show that there's been a progressive, whereas the state supported, you know, art for the schools and consider the artist a worker. In the socialist tradition, the artist was a worker and art was seen as an expert of everyday life. And art was seen as connected with reproduction, as an essential element of reproduction. The desire for beauty, the desire for expressiveness, you know, inseparable from the reproduction of everyday life. And instead, of course, the bourgeois drive to make it special for a few people, you know, the gallery, the museum, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, the art market, right? So she's showing, for instance, that now, you know, the artist has become poor. Now the artist has no support. And they are told from the galleries, why do you want to be paid for showing your work? You should be grateful that we give you the opportunity to express your creativity. So she has been using, so there's been an interesting dialogue and comparison between artwork and domestic work, and all the need, you know, how important it is to struggle, to reconnect, you know, to take away art from the isolation. Capitalism builds walls, separates everything, you know. So art has to be taken away from this isolation, these islands for privileged people, and has to be reconnected with everyday life. And so this is one aspect. And also in the United States, there's been a movement, very interesting movement in the last 20, 30 years. I don't know, people like Cholet, the book Dark Matter, I don't know if you're... So basically insisting that art is a form of production, that the artist is a worker, but also more and more insisting on the need for collectivizing art, in art as a collective practice, not only as an individual one, but also as a collective. And we have seen in the after the killing of George Floyd, yeah, this has exploded in so many Black community. You know, the whole community coming together with some artists, you know, to paint images of Floyd, and then realizing that this collective making of art, it's also a way both to revalue the community, to beautify the community, and bring people together. It's a collective, it's like reclaiming, rediscovering a collective creativity. And I think this is very, very important.
And we are slowly... We slowly came to the end. We usually end our podcast with a series or either or questions.
Oh my God.
You can elaborate on your choice, or you absolutely don't have to, or you can also reject the choice altogether. So can we begin?
Sure.
So the first one, Marx or Lenin?
I go for Marx because Marx is more fundamental. I like Lenin too, but Marx in a way... It's broader in a way. Marx, Lenin needs Marx.
Yeah, exactly.
So Marx has given us a whole analysis that has changed our understanding of the world. You may reject parts of it, you may reject, but nevertheless, the idea of capitalism as a system, yeah, that's fundamental.
Community or collectivity?
Collectivity, collectivity, community, yes, yeah. Yes.
Socialism or communism?
Communism, although communism has become so, yes, so, but socialism has always been social democracy. There's always that element of social democracy. And I think communism is a bit more radical, potentially, not in the way it has been realized. I also grew up in a communist town.
Oh, okay.
My town, Parma, was one of
okay.
Red Emilia.
Lenin or Rosa Luxemburg?
Oh, I don't want to choose between the two. They're both.
Understandably, understandably. Organization or association?
You know, that's very difficult. It's very difficult. I'd have to think it too much more. I mean,
you can choose both of them.
I feel I should say, yeah, both of them. Yeah. Because I think organization is not a bad word.
No.
Organization is important.
Solidarity, we have three more. Solidarity or discipline?
Of course, solidarity. Of course.
Foucault or Butler?
Oh, that too. I don't want to choose among those. Yes.
Okay. And the very last one, taking power or divesting power?
Of course, divesting power. Always divesting power. Never taking power.
Thank you so much. It was really, we truly enjoyed it very much. And
me too. Thank you so much.